did my residency in OBGYN and then did 2 years of research in, well, actually I was a lab tech for a couple of years before medical school, and then after residency I did 2 years of ovarian cancer research at Mass General, and then applied for fellowship and matched here. So right now I'm finishing up my second year in Dr. O'Dunsey's lab, and then I'll be spending 2 years doing surgery and clinical stuff, and then so I figured I would just go over kind of the more of the clinical perspective. You guys probably know more about a lot of the molecular things than I do, but at least we can kind of find some, give you a sense of where we're coming from and maybe some areas where we overlap. And feel free to, you know, jump in at any point with any questions. So I'll go over kind of just general stuff about GYN cancers and then dive into ovarian cancer, and then we'll talk about the other GYN cancers tomorrow. So objectives, basic cancer statistics. We're going to discuss some of the subtypes, surgical treatment, medical treatment, and prevention and novel treatment of ovarian cancer, and then tomorrow endometrial, cervical, and then vulvar and vaginal cancers. So from 2016, this is the age-adjusted mortality rates of in the United States. So, you know, cancer is obviously a very important problem. It's number two on the list, but and of course everybody gives a lot of attention to breast cancer and preventing breast cancer, which is definitely very important, but it's important to remember in talking with your family and friends that heart disease is actually more of a problem than any kind of cancer. And then that comprises almost 600,000 people per year. So heart disease, over 600,000, cancer, 598,000. It's about 22% of all deaths in the United States. The next one down is accidents and unintentional injuries, which is, you know, dwarfed by the first two at only 5.9%. This is the cancer incidence and mortality rates. So in the blue, you'll see the top incidence rates for new cancers. And this is for females, males and females, so breast cancer followed by prostate cancer. Those two kind of tie when you break it down by gender, and then lung and colon cancer are next. Those are things that'll be on pretty much any, like, important exam you probably take, or, like, what are the most frequent cancers. It's breast or prostate, lung, and colon. Right after that is uterine cancer. And then you can see there's basically none of the other GYN cancers are even on here. When you get to the cancer deaths, however, you see that ovary is up here. And so it's pretty rare in general, and we'll go through the numbers, but it actually is just below pancreas and is pretty close. So it's a very deadly cancer considering its incidence is fairly low. And then you'll see further down here is uterine cancer. So even though it's pretty common and on the rise, that the mortality from it is not as much. So this is just the raw numbers looking at it. So for females, uterine cancer, we now have approximately 63,000 cases per year. That's 7% of all cancers. And I remember when I was starting medical school, that number was around 40 or 45,000. So it's like increasing significantly, and we'll talk a little more tomorrow about why that is. And you'll see again, ovarian's not even on here. But when you look down here, ovarian cancer, about 14,000 women per year die of that disease, and that comprises about 5% of cancer deaths in women, and uterine cancer, 4%. And these are just looking at the trends in cancer deaths. This is probably something you've seen before. Lung cancer went up and is now coming down in women. Breast cancer is decreasing. Colon cancer is decreasing. Most of those things are due to better screening and decrease in smoking incidence. And you'll see uterus. This is actually uterus and cervical cancer put together. But you'll see that it decreased significantly over time. A lot of that was probably due to the advent of oral contraceptives. And now you'll see that it's starting to increase again, unfortunately. This is much smaller, sorry. and these are the trends in the incidence. So you'll see that uterine corpus, again, starting to increase again. And the rest are not even on here. So ovarian cancer, it's pretty nasty if you get it. And this is kind of something, this is kind of what it looks like when we get into the operating room. Most of these patients can't have laparoscopic surgery. It ends up being a big open surgery. So the incidence of ovarian cancer, there's about 22,000 per year. And that's, again, about 1.3% of cancer incidence, so it's pretty rare. And then the cancer deaths are about 14,000 per year. That's about 2.3%. We've actually made some progress since the 70s in the five-year survival. It used to be around 33%, and now it's up to about 45-47% for the last few years. Stage at diagnosis. So unfortunately, most patients are diagnosed at an advanced stage of cancer. This is the basic way that we stage things. You don't need to like memorize this, but basically, stage one is tumor that's confined to the ovaries or fallopian tubes. Stage two involves one or both ovaries and fallopian tubes with extension to other pelvic structures like the uterus or the colon. And these are all below the pelvic brim. Stage three means that the tumor involves the ovaries, fallopian tubes, but that it's been confirmed to have spread outside of the pelvis. So further up in the abdomen, oftentimes the omentum, or also to the lymph nodes. And then actually stage three, you can also have metastases to the outside of the liver, because it spreads with that all over the abdomen. And then stage four means that you either have intraparenchymal metastases to the liver, so inside the liver, or lung pleural effusion or other sites outside of the abdominal cavity. And as you might imagine, stage one survival is pretty good, 92%. Stage 2, 70%, so still a significant drop given that it's only a stage 2 and it's pretty localized. Stage 3, the survival drops to 39%, and stage 4, the 5-year survival is 17%. So once it gets beyond the ovaries, it can be pretty deadly. Risk factors for ovarian cancer, things that have increased risk, age, the older you get, the higher your risk, a family history of ovarian cancer or breast cancer, infertility, and low parity. And then things that have a decreased risk is use of oral contraceptive pills, pregnancy, tubal ligation, and breastfeeding. So with oral contraceptives, there have been lots of studies done on this, but generally accepted that greater than 5 years of use of oral contraceptives leads to about a 50% reduction in the risk of ovarian cancer. This has mostly been studied in patients that have genetic predispositions or a higher risk, but it's one of the main things that we use for chemo prevention. So the way it works in theory is that the original theory about how ovarian cancer develops is that it's the epithelial layer on the outside of the ovary, and that the number of ovulations is related to your risk. The number of times that the epithelium ruptures and then heals, and ruptures and heals, ruptures and heals, leads to mistakes over time and the eventual development of ovarian cancer. So anything that decreases the number of ovulatory cycles is going to decrease your risk of ovarian cancer. So oral contraceptives, pregnancy, and breastfeeding, like you saw on the last slide. It's also thought to work through altering gonadotropin secretion, and although those mechanisms haven't really been worked out. Here are some of the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndromes. This is taken from the ACOG, or American College of Obstetrician and Gynecologist practice guidelines about genetic mutations associated with either breast or ovarian cancer. So things such as, BRCA1, BRCA2, BRIP1, Lynch syndrome as well, and then TP53 and STK11 are thought to increase risk of ovarian cancer in different ways. So the most common ones that we mainly deal with are either breast or ovarian cancer are BRCA1 and 2. So with BRCA1, it really depends on the study that you read, but anywhere from kind of a 25 to 40% risk of ovarian cancer. And for BRCA2, it's closer to like 10 to 25% risk of ovarian cancer. In Lynch syndrome, this is usually thought to be an increased risk for uterine cancer, but it also increases your risk for ovarian cancer, which usually would only be 1 to 2% in your life, but it increases the risk between 6 to 20% over your lifetime. And this is looking at a pedigree of a typical family that may have breast or ovarian cancer. So it's not a dominant mutation. You might have a grandmother that's affected but with breast cancer. She has a couple kids. That daughter might have breast cancer. And then this daughter has both breast and ovarian cancer. This son has breast cancer. And then again, his daughter is affected with breast cancer. So anytime you see a male with breast cancer, that's like a red flag because it's so uncommon. And generally we recommend genetic testing for anyone who has a diagnosis of ovarian cancer. So the risk in the general population is about 1.4%. If you have a first degree relative, it's about 5%. And two first degree relatives, it's about 7%. So some of the preventative measures that we use for patients with BRCA 1 and 2 mutations are birth control pills, and those have been found to reduce the risk by, 45 to 60%. A lot of these studies, it just depends on what you read, but these are, kind of the general ballpark. Also, tubal ligation has been found to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer. It actually depends somewhat on the histology, how much the risk is decreased. Anybody have an idea about why that might be? Because it's not actually removing the tubes or the ovaries. So the thought is that you're decreasing the blood flow to the ovaries because there is blood supply both from higher up and from below. So first of all, you're decreasing the blood supply. You're clamping off the tube, so there may be, decreased like communication in terms of either, things that would predispose it to, malignant transformation, infections, inflammation, things like that. But we're still trying to figure that out, actually. But we do know that it decreases the risk, just having a tubal ligation. The combination of tubal ligation and birth control pills for 5 years reduces the risk by about 70%. And then having a bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, which is taking out both the tubes and the ovaries, reduces the risk by 80%. So it actually doesn't reduce it by 100%. And it also reduces the breast cancer by 50%. The thought of behind, we used to say, well, it decreases the risk by 96% because there's a 4% risk of primary peritoneal cancer, which is basically, it looks and acts exactly the same as ovarian cancer, but it doesn't start in the ovaries and it starts somewhere in the peritoneum. A lot of this is thought to be either occult cancers that weren't seen at the time or primary peritoneal cancers. So even though we recommend it for everyone, it does reduce the risk significantly, if not 100%. So ovarian cancers, there are a lot of different kinds arising in different locations. So the one that we typically think of, the big nasty ovarian cancer, those are from the surface epithelium. The different histologies of epithelial tumors are generally serous, mucinous, endometrioid, clear cell and transitional cell carcinomas. There's also germ cell tumors, and those are coming from like the actual egg or the primordial follicle that's inside the ovary, and those can turn into just dysgerminomas, yolk sac tumors, embryonal cell tumors, choriocarcinomas, and teratomas. And then sex cord stromal tumors, these are the supporting cells either around the follicle or within the ovary. And these various tissues can turn into either granulosa cell tumors, sarcomas, fibromas, Sertoli cell, Sertoli Leydig cell tumors, and other steroid producing tumors. Histologically, the distribution is, you know, mostly epithelial cancers. There are about 8% are sex cord stromal tumors and 26 germ cell tumors. But a lot of the statistics you'll see are at least like 70% or more are epithelial tumors. I'm not sure what happened there. Oh, yeah. So here are just some pictures of ovarian cancer and what it might look like. So pretty nasty looking. This looks like the intestines and all these little like studding everywhere. That's all tumor. You know, this is the colon, and all this is like the fatty tissue around it. All this little stuff, this is all tumor. This looks like a big tumor down there. This is a CT scan of what you might see. So like a big nasty looking tumor here, like kind of thick walls and thickening of the surface of the abdomen. This is a dermoid cyst. This is a different kind of ovarian cancer. This is the uterus. This is looking through a laparoscopic. That's like a normal right ovary. This is the intestines, and this is a dermoid cyst. So versus this that has all these like nasty, you know, spread everywhere. This is kind of just hanging out. Looks bigger, but it doesn't look as gross. These are dermoid tumors, and we'll talk more about them in a minute, but they, because they're coming from the egg, essentially, they can turn into any cell type, and oftentimes they'll contain hair. They're often have like sebum, and they're totally disgusting. In my opinion, some people love them, other people hate them. They can produce like thyroid tissue. They can create hyperthyroidism. They can have like neural elements. They can be really cool and interesting. But most of the time, they're just kind of gross. And then this is, I think it's probably a granulosa cell tumor or dysgerminoma. Anyway, so germ cell cancers, they're derived from the germ cell of the ovary. About 2 to 3% are malignant. The most common germ cell tumor is the mature cystic teratoma or the dermoid, which is what I was just talking about. You can see here there's some hair. This looks like maybe sebum. You can also see teeth in them, like really bizarre. Then the most common germ cell tumor, which is benign, dermoid cyst. And then the most common malignant tumor is a dysgerminoma, and that's this guy here. It actually produces a lot of glycogen and has this kind of like, you know, funny look here. This is all like glycogen stuff in there. And those are just nicely contained, and you know, you usually just treat them surgically. Then we have the sex cord stromal tumors, and these are all the supporting cells around the ovary. So granulosa cell tumors generally lead to either precocious puberty if they're in young women, or abnormal bleeding if they're in older women. This is a picture of one of the granulosa cell tumors, and that's because they produce estrogen. So sometimes we'll see like a, you know, 6 or 7 year old that has vaginal bleeding that shouldn't be. That's one of the things we would do to, you know, work them up, is to look for an ovarian estrogen-producing tumor. Or like in a postmenopausal woman who's 70, if she's having abnormal bleeding, that's one of the possible causes. Sarcomas are benign hormone-producing tumors. There's fibromas, which are benign connective tissue tumors. And this is a fibroma down here. You can see it's like very smooth and kind of homogeneous. It's made of connective tissue. And those don't produce any hormones generally. And then there are Sertoli or Sertoli Leydig cell tumors, and those lead to masculinization. For example, you know, like hair growth, deepening of the voice, hirsutism. So when someone presents with, you know, a sudden change or they suddenly have signs of virilization, that's one of the things that we'll look for. So this is a slide that looks at the different types of cancer and some of the different mutations that are predominant. So what we mostly see are these high-grade serous types. They almost universally have a P53 mutation, which is not surprising. A lot of them have BRCA1 and 2 mutations. And sometimes that's a germline mutation, sometimes it's methylated in the tumor, sometimes it's a loss within the tumor. RB, CDK, some of the homologous recombination repair genes, Notch, you know, the unfortunate thing about high-grade serous cancers is that they're very variable, and so, you know, it can be beneficial in some of our immunotherapy approaches, but it makes it very difficult to target in other ways. So there's also something called low-grade serous ovarian cancers, which are not that common. They tend to have BRAF, KRAS, and ERBB2 mutations. Then we have mucinous tumors. These are actually kind of a different beast than most of the other epithelial tumors. The biggest risk factor for that is smoking. And these things can actually get, like, huge, but oftentimes they're benign. And these tend to have KRAS or HER2 mutations or amplifications. Clear cell tumors, one of the main mutations that kind of helps us differentiate. So this is the ARID1A mutation. They can also have PIK3CA or P10 mutations, some of these others. And both clear cell and endometrioid tumors can, we often see in patients who've had a history of endometriosis, and it's thought that they're coming from a transformation of some of this, endometrial tissue that's kind of ectopically placed within the abdomen. And then for the non-epithelial tumors, they're totally different and are going to have different mutations. So lots of new strategies to come up with. That's where you guys come in. So when we think about ovarian cancer, the big problem is that most patients have late-stage disease because their symptoms are kind of vague. When I learned about this in medical school, I said, oh, you know, symptoms are usually bloating, some vague abdominal discomfort, abdominal pain, urinary frequency, some pelvic pressure, dyspepsia, and like the whole class thought they had ovarian cancer because who doesn't have some of these symptoms sometimes? So that's kind of the problem. We don't have a good way to screen for it at this point. Diagnosis of ovarian cancer, routine pelvic exams in asymptomatic women detect only 1 in 10,000 ovarian cancers. It's probably even worse than when they did this study because of the advent of obesity. I mean, now it's even harder to feel anything, so we're pretty much terrible at it. But generally, it's kind of a side view. This is like a vaginal and a rectovaginal exam where we're trying to palpate. This is the uterus here, and then we're putting our hand on the outside of the abdomen and trying to squish everything in between to feel any masses. So you can imagine if you have like a really big BMI that it's really hard to feel anything. Tumor markers. So this is probably important to know generally. For epithelial ovarian cancer, CA125 is something that we look for and oftentimes follow. So the problem with that is it's only elevated in about 50% of ovarian cancers that are in stage one, so it's not good for being sensitive and picking it up early, but it does increase with the stage of disease, so we can use it to follow, and oftentimes we use it to follow recurrences, but it's not good to be able to detect it before it spreads. Dysgerminomas will produce LDH. Endodermal sinus tumors produce alpha fetoprotein, which makes sense. These are also called yolk sac tumors. Choriocarcinoma, those produce human chorionic gonadotropin. Granulosa cell tumors produce inhibin B, which is part of the feedback mechanism for estradiol. And embryonal cell tumors also produce HCG. They don't all follow the textbook, but generally that's true. So when we're suspicious and we're looking for something, ultrasound findings that are concerning. So things that have thin walls and look like a simple cyst make us feel good, and things that have thick walls and external blood flow make us feel bad. So this is an ultrasound image, and you can see, so the dark stuff is fluid, and you can see these nice thin septations. That would be okay if it weren't for all this stuff. This is like solid, nasty looking stuff, and I'm sure that's a big ovarian cancer. And then over here, they're kind of looking for the blood flow to some of those solid areas, and you can see it has significant, like, arterial blood flow. And that's not, we shouldn't find it in those areas. So the current standard of care for advanced ovarian cancer, what we do is surgical staging with a GYN oncologist, and we aim to get maximal tumor debulking to get every last microscopic piece out. That's followed by 6 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy with a taxane. And traditionally 1 centimeter of residual tumor, but we now know that the more you get out, the better. For staging surgery, what we do is first when we get into the abdomen, we do peritoneal washings to see if there's nothing obvious, to see if there's any tumor cells just floating around in the cytology specimen. And then we look in the diaphragm, the right and left abdomen and pelvis, and we inspect and palpate all the peritoneal surfaces. We biopsy or take a smear from the right hemidiaphragm, which is where some of these tumors sometimes first start spreading. We biopsy all suspicious lesions, and we do an infracolic omentectomy, so we take out that fatty layer that's hanging off of the colon, because that's one of the first places it spreads. Biopsy or resection of any adhesions, because those can actually often just be cancer. We do a random biopsy of different peritoneal surfaces like the bladder flexion and the cul-de-sac of near the colon, the pelvic side walls. We do a pelvic and periaortic lymph node dissection if we see suspicious lymph nodes, and then we do a total abdominal hysterectomy and a bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. To quote one of our more famous researchers, surgical bulk resection is of little value unless all gross tumor is excised. So this is what we would call an omental cake. So whereas the normal fatty tissue should feel like any kind of fatty tissue, this we call an omental cake because it's thickened and it's stiff as a board and it's like a cake of tumor. This is another look at it. You can see, again, all these little nodules everywhere. So some people have disease that's easy to take out, and they're just big chunks, and other people have this kind of miliary stuff that's just kind of a little bit everywhere, and that's much harder to take out. So this is one of the studies that looked at survival based on the residual disease after surgery. And this is one of the reasons why we do these aggressive surgeries. So when they looked at macroscopic disease that was left behind greater than a centimeter per lesion versus macroscopic less than a centimeter versus microscopic, you couldn't see anything left. The survival is obviously much better in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival. So the more you take out, the better patients do. And it translates into significant progression-free survival advantages and overall survival advantages. I mean, you more than double the survival if you have microscopic versus 1 centimeter disease left over. Something else that we've been starting to do more of is neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which is something that's definitely used in other cancers. This is chemotherapy that's given before surgery. It allows patients who have unresectable disease at their initial presentation to have a higher chance of having a maximal cytoreduction. So if someone has, like their whole intestines or the blood vessels that supply the whole intestines are involved, we can't take out their whole intestines. Like, that's not compatible with life. So, or people who have disease in their chest. I mean, things that are just a little above the diaphragm, sometimes we take out, but if it's everywhere, we can't do that. So, it's also useful for patients who are medically compromised. So, like, you know, your 95-year-old who, you know, is sharp as a tack up here, but has a lot of medical problems, who wants to give it a go, you know. We'll sometimes do a little bit of chemo first and then try to get them maximally cytoreduced. And then one of the helpful components about this is that we have ongoing research into molecular changes pre and post chemotherapy. So, you know, we're getting biopsies before we do the chemotherapy to make sure that we have the right kind of cancer. They get 3 cycles of chemotherapy or 4. They go to the OR and look for and take out all their tumor, and then we kind of can see what's happening on the molecular level and on the, you know, in the immune microenvironment, things like that, between the naive tumor and chemotherapy. There are some people who have early stage disease and who are young. So we can really only do fertility sparing surgery for people who have stage 1 disease, generally only from nulliparous women. We do a one-sided salpingo oophorectomy. We do a hysteroscopy, which is like looking inside the uterus with a camera and doing like a sampling from inside the uterus. We'll do the same washings in the peritoneum, do some biopsies and lymph node dissection and take out the omentum. And then once their childbearing is complete, we'll do a hysterectomy and basically the rest of their surgery. And we usually send them to our reproductive endocrinology colleagues, and this is kind of an emerging field of interest, is, you know, how to best preserve fertility in some of these early stage patients, not just in ovarian cancer, but in other cancer types as well. So common sites of spread, so just got kind of cut off here, sorry. So I think actually the next one is better. Yeah, this is a better picture. So this is the uterus, the fallopian tubes, and the ovaries. So this is where the cancer starts. And unlike other tumors that a lot of them have a hematogenous spread, these just kind of slough off the outside of the uterus, and they just kind of start mixing around into the fluid that's in the peritoneum. They may go to the lymph nodes that are like right under where the ovaries sit. It may metastasize to the surface of the uterus. Here's the colon, it's also right there. And then a lot of these cancer cells end up kind of attaching to this omentum. And that's why we take this out in the staging surgery. So it just spreads everywhere, unfortunately. Stages, kind of went over this a little bit before, but 1 is 1 or both ovaries, 2 is other pelvic organs, 3 is outside the pelvis or peritoneal metastases, and stage 4 is the distant metastases, excluding the peritoneal metastases. And then the treatment is, after surgery we do chemotherapy. There are a couple different regimens, but generally we use paclitaxel and carboplatin, and they get 6 cycles of these 2 drugs every 3 weeks. Some people have reactions, so we do have, you know, alternatives that we give them. You know, generally one of the problems with the Taxol is neuropathy, so some patients who we might want to retreat with that later end up we can't do that, or if they already have neuropathy from something else. So it's all about balancing the pros and cons, but generally we do Taxol and carboplatin. Patients usually do okay. Another thing that's been tried and that we sometimes do is intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So it's different than HIPEC. HIPEC is something that they'll do in the actual surgery, where they do heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy. That's kind of being tested, but this is basically putting a catheter so that it stays in the abdomen and we can put the chemotherapy directly into the peritoneum. The theory is that you're delivering higher doses of chemotherapy directly to the tumor cells, that it's going to have a longer half-life because you're not having you know, the first pass metabolism of the drug through the liver, and that and it works best on minimal disease because basically it's not going being delivered through the blood and the capillaries. It's just the direct contact with the tumor cells, so it works best when you only have like 1 to 2 millimeters of residual disease. Unfortunately, it's pretty tough to get through. People have a lot of pain and can still have a lot of metabolic problems and nausea and vomiting. So it works best on patients who are younger and healthy, but who and have minimal disease left. But, you know, some of the results have been really that they have a significantly better survival. Some more recent studies say maybe not, so we're kind of moving away from it a little bit, but I think it's interesting. And then an important concept in ovarian cancer is platinum sensitivity, so the duration of your response. So after your primary chemotherapy, after your surgery, if you do not have a complete response, so when they do a CAT scan at the end, if you still have tumor left over, you're considered treatment refractory. So you did not have a response. Most ovarian tumors are very responsive. That's bad. You don't want to be in that category. Fortunately, most patients aren't. And then we start counting from the time that you finish your primary treatment. If you recur within 6 months, then you're considered platinum resistant, which is also not great. If you recur between 6 and 12 months or beyond 12 months, then you're considered platinum sensitive, and that's where you want to be. And the longer, they've done studies looking at the longer your platinum-free interval, the better you do in terms of your response to the next treatment and in terms of your overall survival. So I think that's kind of an interesting area of research, is what makes something platinum-resistant, platinum-refractory versus platinum-sensitive. So you'll see here if you're less than 6 months out from treatment, your overall response rate to any therapy, never mind your survival, but just your, like, even any response to therapy is only around 12%. If you have 12 to 18 months, about 30%. And if it's greater than 18 months, you're about 60%. So this has been shown again and again in multiple studies. So goals for improving patient survival, basically enrollment in clinical trials, and that's what we do here, clinical trials. Aggressive surgical management by well-trained specialists. So actually probably most ovarian cancer patients get debulking by non-GYN oncologists, by, you know, random general surgeons in the community or a general gynecologist who is like really far from anywhere else, because a lot of patients can't afford to travel. They've looked at, you know, high, you know, tertiary centers versus everyone else, and people do much better when they get guideline care. Getting that maximal tumor cytoreduction, and then getting adjuvant chemotherapy with platinum and taxane-based regimens in a timely manner. So, as I said, you get your surgery, you get your Taxol carboplatin for 6 cycles, about 70 to 90% get remission. Then they go on to surveillance, and then about 70 to 90% recur. And then we go on to second-line treatment. And only about 10 to 15% of advanced ovarian cancers will be long-term survivors, unfortunately. So future research directions. Firstly, effective screening. So currently there's no effective screening. We've tried everything in regards to, you know, ultrasounds and CA125s and, you know, different biomarkers, and at this point nothing has been found to improve survival. So, you know, we haven't really made any progress on that front. Early detection, this is biomarker development, so please help us on that front. Prevention, you know, we're learning more and more about, you know, how to, you know, decrease people's risk by doing, you know, surgery and chemo prevention, but we certainly need to do a lot more there. Overcoming chemo resistance. So targeted therapies such as PARP inhibitors, some of the more recent trials looking at folate receptor alpha targeting antibodies, mucin targeting antibodies, And then, of course, immunotherapy, which is what we love to do here. So we use, we're currently doing trials with checkpoint inhibition and combinations of checkpoint inhibitors and other agents, doing trials with cancer testis antigens, looking at the immunoprofiles of different ovarian tumors, looking at TIL therapy and ACT, and also genetically modified TCRs and CAR T-cell therapies. Those are a little bit further out. And then I was just going to share with you one of the papers that one of our previous fellows published on one of the cancer testis antigens. So NY-ESO-1 has been found to predict an aggressive phenotype of ovarian cancer. So if you look at patients who are negative for NY-ESO versus those who are positive, just in no trial, and you can see that those who are positive and didn't go on to trial had a worse prognosis than those who were NY-ESO negative. So if you have it, it's bad because you do worse. But if you were positive and actually you went on to be on a clinical trial targeting NY-ESO using a vaccine, you improved your overall survival. I mean, here it comes together a little bit. And actually, even your survival after relapse was improved by being on the trial. And again, it was worse if you did not have go into the vaccine trial compared to the negative patients. But if you were positive and went on to the trial, you did better. So showing us that we can make these differences and, you know, just gotta keep going and get more money for cancer research and all that good stuff. So, you guys have any questions? This is the one that we should probably, I think it's on here somewhere, but just leave that one out. Just leave that one out and all the rest is fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks.